In the evening talk with you, I'd like to explore some of the themes that you just proposed, and perhaps focusing a little bit on the judging mind. It has been brought up each day, as it does in each day of our life, in various ways, and to touch upon on that. We, in many ways that we could describe life, and certainly a useful one would be to describe life as a field of experience. But it's a field of experience in which we move, in fact, from one forms and manifestations of experience into another. And our life unfolds itself day in, day out, year in, year out. And the experiences that we have of life do become, of course, both in past and in present, the influential and way that we are primarily informed about life. And we have also the capacity in life in which we can be removed from the here and now and first-hand experience at times in life, and we have this capacity, which is very useful and can be very appropriate, almost sometimes to use thought as a kind of substitute for experience. In many ways that you and I can do that. So here's a situation of our life. It's passing by from one day to the next. Life influences us. The world influences us. We influence the world. And, as I say, many experiences coming and influencing our future as much as our present. And we also have the capacity as human beings, and rather an unusual one, to be able to infer. I don't know what it is like over there. I don't know about this situation. I can't go here, there and everywhere, but I can make some kind of inference. I can draw views. I can form judgments about things, even if I haven't had first-hand experience. And so our world and our relationship to life is often connected with what we actually experience and what comes out of the experience, and also the necessity in life to be clear with ourselves in terms of what we don't experience but which we infer. And from our inferring, that means from our drawing a conclusion, or from our forming of an opinion of, we need to be aware of what it's actually connected to. And there's quite often, as human beings, we have a remarkable habit, really, and it needs to be addressed with ourselves. And it's a habit of not recalling or remembering the sources of information, the sources of judgment. And so sometimes the sources of judgment are just coming from other people, and they say something, we remember it, we internalize it, and sometimes parrot-like we repeat it. And when this movement of the dynamics of flow of judgments and views and opinions goes on, nobody can quite remember who started it, or where it began, but it gets a kind of life of its own, and it does the rounds, called gossip, called chattering mind, called second-hand information, or whatever it might be. And it takes a certain awareness in our life, and receptivity in life, is where does these opinions come from? Where do these views come from? About anything in life, of course, about anything. And one of the aspects of all of that which takes place terribly easily for us is that we can be very strong about our views and about our judgments, about whatever it might be. And it's as though they are utterly original, or it's the first time it's been said, or the first time it's been thought, or whatever. And again, in our awareness of life and the judgments and views which come, it take some awareness and perhaps for all of us some degree of humility to know, where are these opinions formed from? What are the influences? Where are they coming from? Sometimes they're just inherited. They're inherited. And one notices that in our inherited views and opinions, they can be passed on through many, many generations, from the past through to the present. And each generation has this incredible assurance that this is the truth of the matter, with very strong judgment, and not quite realizing that the record has just repeated itself, as it did with one's mother and father and their mother and father, and probably going back to Adam and Eve, but they probably wouldn't want to take responsibility and would pass it on a bit further still. So there's this extraordinary situation in life where the world of views and opinions, the world of strong judgments, does have an extraordinary impact on the earth, on the life of human beings, on the life of creatures, on the very future, as well as present, of our whole ecosystem. It's under the shadow of what the way that you and I think and talk about the world. And we see that the judgments which are made are judgments which have, all of them, their origination in the mind. The mind forms the judgment, identifies strongly with the judgment, and puts the judgment out. And the judgments that we have do have an ongoing impact and influence on the world that we live in. And yet, we can't find, where did it originate? How did it start? How is it that there's this interplay and interdynamic of views and opinions going on in this world that you and I live in, and yet it seems so impersonal, passing backwards and forwards, backwards and forwards? And even when you and I specialize in some particular area of life which is of great interest to us, we realize that no matter what you and I know about any particular topic, we only touch the tip of the iceberg. One just has to go into one's own library, one has the privilege of having a library, and look at the shelf of books on any theme that you and I are interested in. So there's this human mind, your mind and my mind, going through our day-to-day life with a little bit of information that you and I have and a little bit of knowledge that you and I have, knowing sometimes we just can express in the moment or in the words or in the letter or in the book or in the encyclopedia or in the classroom just a little bit, and what you and I can know is tiny compared with the extent of what we don't know. The unknown fills the existence. And yet we've come to a rather conclusion in our life. We know. And the stronger we are, you and I are, stronger, no matter how much information and knowledge that you and I might have, and how much time we devote to it, I still say the unknown is much, much bigger and much greater than the known. And we need some humility in our mind to know what's known and what is unknown. This has a particular important part to play in our relationship to the future. Future? What future? Where is the future? It's like we've got this huge big space and we call it the future. And then the mind moves, and into this big space called the future, we can throw anything into it. And our welfare, our contentment, our peace of mind rather depends on what we throw into the future. So here we are, here and now, living our life one day to the next, and then arises the future. My future, our future, and in the Green Movement, our future means the future of the Earth. In this big space of the future, tremendous judgments and opinions get thrown into it. One has the positivists, we'll get over this crisis on this planet, things will get better, things will improve, we've got over the last ones, and we'll get over this one. There are the negatives, world's going downhill rapidly, there's not a chance. We're at the beginning of the end here, and we may as well accept it. And some are very, very strong in their views, politically, economically, corporately, religiously, have tremendous view, conviction about the view. What's the evidence? What is the information that we are drawing upon to form the opinion, the judgment, and the view about the future? Sometimes it's very personal, of course. I'm with somebody, and he or she has said, I'm not sure if I'm going to be with you any longer. Panic. Just nothing but panic. Panic about what? Panic about the future. And that panic and the insecurity and the discomfort with it is related very directly, and quite a few of you during the days here have spoken about this, simply born out of what the person that one loves, cares for, is close to, has said in a particular moment. And it can just take one particular sentence in a moment of frustration, boredom, anger, agitation, one sentence, I'm thinking of leaving you. And it can enter into the heart and mind of the one who is close and have dramatic impact, which seems to be far greater than the single short sentence that was said. The person says it, they've forgotten about it the next day, but the partner's recovering for the next decade. If they ever do. So in our relationship to our what we say and what we put out, it can be that the single line has far more impact and influence than what we would anticipate or what we would ever expect. From the impact, it hits something strong within, usually the emotions, but not always. And in the impact of that, it unsettles the flow of the changing experiences of life. How do you and I deal with a remark, with a comment, with a statement which outwardly makes the future appear unsure? Unsure. I was in my local printers recently, and talking with him, and he told me about a friend of his, and the friend had been experiencing some fairly uncomfortable pains in the lower part of the back and the stomach area, and went to see his the local physician. And this person had, as some people do, understandably, had avoided going to see the doctor. Some people just, last minute, if they have to go to the doctor, it's a last minute thing. And he, for some months, had been avoiding it. And he went to see the doctor. The doctor said that he needed x-rays and treatment immediately to see what the problem was. And told the patient, who was a man in his mid-40s, to come back the following week for the results of the tests. When he came back the following week, the doctor had sitting beside him a counsellor. The information that the doctor gave to his patient was, he said, "I'm very, very sorry to have to tell you, but you only have 7 days to live." Now, can one imagine the impact of such a statement on a person's life through a visit to the doctor? How would we be? How would we respond? We don't know. None of us know. None of us can say what resources are within us, how we would deal with such information. And I just put it into a context, obviously dramatic story, but I put it into a context in that in our relationship to life, we hear, and we need to hear very deeply, I do feel, the significance of the here and now and the relationship to it. And sometimes before we really genuinely understand the very deep and profound significance of the steadiness with life, and what it really means to be grounded and the trust that's required for that. And similarly in life, in our relationship to the here and now and the judgments that take place, when you and I, the thought wanders to the future, as it does, and quite appropriately so, that when it does, it's not just the thought of the future which is occurring for us, but what's also occurring is the movement of our inner life in relationship to. The movement of the inner life in relationship to the future thought. How is that movement? What does that movement tell us? What kind of feelings, moods? When do we notice ourselves thinking most strongly about the future? What kind of occasions does that come up for us? And so, impact of small isolated events do have an impact, and then movement into the future occurs there. And sometimes within us and between us, we need very clear reminders, be here and now, this is it. And to, like the hawk in the sky, which hovers above the fields, in a way, with our awareness, we need that same kind of vigilance to be the hawk, which is extraordinarily careful and vigilant about what the future thought does, what it actually does. Sometimes we have an experience and we zoom off into the future on huge waves of positivity, grandiose ideas, quite out to lunch, disconnected from life, disconnected from here and now, and we didn't realize that in that movement into the future from the here and now, that as the time goes by, we may have sown the seeds for an immense degree of disappointment. Why do I feel so disappointed? Why am I so disappointed in the way things have worked out, whatever it might be in life? Maybe we sowed the seeds in the past, we reaped the fruit in the present, and in our innocence we didn't realize it. Can we have an easygoing relationship to the unfoldment of life, and in that easygoing relationship to it, not biting too much on the future? In our relationship to our inner life, in terms of judgments and all that goes on, in one of the groups today, one of the people in the group brought up a very important area, and one which is familiar, I'm sure, to many. And that is, we can have certain kinds of inner experiences which take place, and we have a relationship to them. The way that we think about them. How do we think about our inner experiences? And in the relationship we have with our inner experiences, I asked one person, and the response can vary quite a lot from one person to another, what seems to be more important to you? Your experience or your relationship to it? The experience, let us say, could be extremely difficult that's going on inside of oneself. And then the relationship to it, oh my God, I hope this doesn't continue. I don't want to go on feeling like this. I want to get rid of this as quickly as possible. And the relationship to it is one of agitation or whatever. Or the relationship to it can be one of being judge, prosecutor, jury, and as somebody ruefully commented, executioner as well. We can be a heavier judge upon ourselves than anybody else could ever be. Why? We're so close to ourselves. So the inner judge can sometimes be vicious and hard towards ourselves. Judge, jury, prosecutor, and it's something about the relationship emerging out of the mind in the way that we look at ourselves. And we ask ourselves, as we need to, what will take us into a way of being in this world in which we are not living our inner life in the courtroom? Basically, we can spend our life in court. Who would want to spend their life in court? Yet, that's what happens with the judge and the jury situation. Why is it that we can give such authority? When are we going to lose the interest in giving authority to the judge with the harsh and hard opinions that go upon ourselves? When are we going to send some loving kindness to the judge? A little bit of warmth to the prosecutor. A bit of friendship to the jury. Open up the cells of the court. Say, hey, there's light and sunlight in here. We don't have to continue in this harsh world upon ourselves. Because if we are harsh and hard upon ourselves, when it's too uncomfortable, we'll direct it to others. When it's too uncomfortable to direct it to others, we'll direct it back to ourselves. And that will become our world. What's the softer voice inside? What's another way of listening to ourselves? Can the relationship to ourselves be one of rather faithfully just keeping in touch with the bare description of the experience? Right now, the experience which I am feeling is anxiety. Right now, the experience which I am feeling inside is contentment. Just that the description, in the description there's no judge and jury. Just the bare description of the experience as a responsible relationship to experience. Can we go from a description, in the same way from judging to a description, in the same way that you and I look outside and we see the trees and the flowers and somebody says, oh, look at the lovely colour of the artichokes, as somebody said. Another person said, oh, look at the lovely flowers and the lovely way the path has been swept for us today. Just simple descriptions of life which are taking place. Can we describe that? And as a small reminder of simple fact, a little while ago, just before coming in here, there was a scorpion in the corridor. And fortunately, having, like many of you, much more familiar with scorpions than I, but they're easy to grab and take out. But it zoomed away under that chest of jaws, just over there. I just mention it as a small encouragement, in fact, to be mindful. And all these creatures are black. They're black, no problem, not white, black. Black widow. And yes, whose name was on it? later in the year, I have to I go to Australia to give some teachings in the forest there, and the situation of one of great simplicity, people in tents and some huts, and the meditation hall was built by the trees which had fallen down in the forest, and it's very bare minimal conditions there. And on my last visit there, we were in the meditation hall, about the same number of us there, and I was in the middle of the afternoon, and I was just sitting on the cushion, etc. And then from the middle of the hall, in the middle of the silence, somebody said, "I'm scared." Now, all sorts of things have occurred in the in meditation retreats and halls, and you name it, it's happened in meditation halls. And I couldn't quite see. Well, and then I kind of leaned across there, and the person had their meditation shawl around them. They were sitting on the floor, cross-legged, and on their lap was a snake, more than a meter long, straight up, pointing at the face of this guy. And the room was unusually still from that point. And in that, he said to me, well, you know, from the throat, "Is it poisonous?" And I turned to Mac, who's a friend of mine who's sitting there, who lives at Bodhi Farm, which is a community of ours right next to the forest. And I said to him, "Mac, you know, is it poisonous?" Because I didn't know the snake. And he said no. then he said out of the corner of his mouth, he said, "A little bit." So meanwhile, this poor guy, he was from Brisbane, from the city, and the snake is just moving backwards and forwards there. And then the snake relaxed, and it just made its way across the legs and across the floor of the meditators to find its way out. And the name of the snake was called Australia, a night tiger. Tigers are very dangerous. It's a night tiger, not so dangerous. And I couldn't understand how on earth, in the middle of a hall, did a snake land up on somebody's lap. Nobody knew about it, and wavering like this.
Excuse me, just checking.
Yes, right. And what had happened was that the snake sleeps during the day, and it was on the rafter, and it got too hot on the rafter, and it tried to move off the rafter, and everywhere it was just too hot, it was stuck up there, and it had fallen straight off and straight onto this guy's lap. The ironic thing of the situation was that in the inquiry the previous day, he had talked about the major issue, as he described, of his life. And he said the major issue of his life was control issues. And I had said to him in the inquiry, "You know, just how difficult, how bad are your control issues?" He said, "They're terrible." He said, "They're so bad that I can't be a passenger in a car because I'm not in control. And if I do get into a car and somebody else is driving," he said, "I'm just in terror every kilometer of the way because I can't control it." He says, "These are very major control issues." And I thought it was rather ironic that he's there with the shawl around him, his arms under the shawl, sitting meditating, the following day, snakes on his lap. It's a situation totally out of control. And sometimes in our life, I think, as Einstein once commented, you know, if we could throw a stone hard enough in one direction, eventually it will come back and hit us on the back of the head. And I think that happened to him, and I'm sure it happened to us. that those issues in life which we do our absolutely best never to get near, never to touch, never to deal with, never to face, never to work with, etc., etc., life in the unfoldment of experiences comes round and says, wait a minute, this is it. Whatever the issue is, somehow or other we end up having to deal with it, having to face it. And life does that in a way which you and I can never quite fathom out. Something almost mysterious, almost mystical in the interdynamics of life, the way these things occur and come together. I remember when in being in India, and some of you have been on the road, have travelled well and extensively, and quite often the conversation starts in India if you meet a fellow traveller, where are you from? And they say, I'm English, I'm from England, UK. Oh, yes, so am I. And then I remember one conversation was in Dharamsala, in the foothills of the Himalayas. And the person said, it's part of England. I said, oh, Surrey. He said, oh, yeah, I'm from Surrey. Which part of Surrey? I said, oh, I'm from Croydon. Croydon, yeah, I'm from Croydon. He said, which part of Croydon? I said, Saunderstead. I'm from Saunderstead. He said, what road do you live in? I said, Kendall Avenue. He said, so do I. He said, what number? There we parted company. So sometimes in this world of moving around, we have what we call coincidences. We have meetings and connections and link-ups. And I'm sure if you and I had the opportunity, or you with each other, talked with each other, and we say, oh, I don't know you, I haven't met you before, I haven't seen you before, I think we could find incredible close connections with each other. If one just took a few connections, and we would find some links with each other, perhaps mutual friends, perhaps relatives, perhaps deep loved ones, and that we are much more closer. But we don't know it. We don't have the knowledge. We don't know where that closeness is, what form that it takes. And we can look into ourselves, into the depth of ourselves. Well, do I really need to know somebody through those links-ups? And the person and I became friends, of course, and we talked, and I saw him some years later, etc., etc. When I returned home, I walked down the street for about 10 doors and knocked on his front door. He said, don't worry, he's doing all right. He's still in the Himalayas, but he's doing okay, etc. And in all of that. So sometimes they say the known is helpful and useful. It helps to make a link. It helps to make a connection. But do we need always the known to feel close with each other, to feel that sense of deep common humanity? Do we need, do you and I need to use the same label to feel close? Do we have to rely on labels? Do we have to rely on descriptions? Do we have to rely upon the gender? Do we have to rely on a similar interest, a similar object of focus? Is the known necessary for intimacy? So, as I say, whatever our inner life is, its movement, its unfoldment, its expression, its manifestation, also comes with it, of course, the thoughts about it. Hopefully our thoughts, we can explore, as I said, that the thoughts become descriptive more than anything else. And from the description of things, that can touch the heart in a way which these heavy judgments may not do so in a satisfactory way. And sometimes we make further kind of links with each other. I've been reminded once or twice of some very good friends of mine, Dharma teachers. Most of you are familiar with the word Dharma, D-H-A-R-M-A. Dharma means spiritual teachings. Dharma is generally a word which is directly connected with the Buddhist tradition, but also used in the Hindu tradition. And in the Buddhist tradition, the word Dharma means teachings which are concerned with enlightenment, teachings which are concerned with realization, with depth of being, with a moral and ethical relationship to life in which others matter as much as oneself, regardless of everything. And the Dharma teachings bring people together in various ways, and quite extensive networks have been established worldwide in the Dharma world. And Buddhism can be a valuable support for Dharma teachings, and sometimes I think Buddhism can be a distraction as well. All of this we need to look at and care in our relationship to all of these things. And I remember some years ago, again in India, some of the friends that I met there, and we were exposed to spiritual teaching. Sometimes we were ordained, sometimes staying in particular places or particular teachers as lay people. And a number of us, particularly in India and Thailand, became good friends. And in the about the mid-1970s, some of us came back to give Vipassana teachings, and the friendship now is 20-25 years old in some cases. And there are five of us who, two of us in Britain and three in the United States. And what was unusual about it was that for most traditions coming from the East to the West, the original teachers were in fact Asian teachers. In the Zen tradition, there were Zen masters from Japan and Korea, Tibetan masters, and the Theravadins from Sri Lanka or Thailand. But in the Vipassana tradition, the teachings were from Westerners who had gone to the East, spent varying lengths of time there, had been encouraged by our teachers to come and to return to the West to give the teachings. And five of us have been and remained, as I said, close friends. The names of four of them, one is three in the States, one is Joseph Goldstein, another is Jack Kornfield, another is Saren Salzberg, who Stephen has invited to come here in September, the other is Christina Feldman, and the fifth is myself. Now, I'm sure you can see a pretty common denominator amongst four of them. And that's quite widespread, of course, in elsewhere as well. And so the language which has come to be called of my friends who have a strong Jewish background. In Christina's case, she married Murray Feldman from a Jewish family and was, of course, exposed, connected that way. But one of the common factors of the Jewish background, so a word was devised for those who have a Jewish background but have a love and practice in the Buddhist tradition, and they're called Buish. And being Buish has come to be a kind of term of much love and affection, particularly in the United States, where there are lots of people in the Buish tradition. It's only 20 years old, but it's, we hope it will last as long as the Jewish tradition, but we'll have to see. We'll have to see. And in that interaction which takes place, of course, similarities and differences, and those who get exposed to these kind of practices and with different teachers and teachings. Important thing in all of this, which has come back to my earlier point as well, is what is our experience? Just as you and I can form all sorts of views and opinions about many, many things, I think it's rather vital and important to see through one's direct first-hand experience. To me, even if we don't, our relationship to our experience is not very satisfactory, it's still the best form of authority in life. First-hand experience. And in that, we might hear from others very approving or disapproving we may hear from the voices of authority in spiritual life, very approving or disapproving. And we can listen to those and hear those, but never let the judgment and the opinion of others, whether with authority, such as myself in this case, or not with authority, just friends and contacts, whatever, be the overwhelming influence. Never let it be the overwhelming influence. So that we can say, ah, this is your experience there. Let me see what my experience is. And let me, particularly in my experience, whatever it is, coming back to the earlier point that's made, from the experience, what is the interpretation? What is the interpretation of the experience? And in that, as you and I have been talking over the days, the interpretation of the experience can change significantly. It's not that in life that you and I have an experience and then the interpretation stays exactly the same. So our experience needs clarity and spaciousness and wisdom around it, but equally so does the interpretation. How many times have you and I had something difficult happen to us? I talked about being separated from a loved one before, or getting sick on a holiday, or having to endure a meditation retreat, all those difficult areas of life. And one says to oneself at the time, the judgment which is formed about it is, glad I'm over, I'm glad that's finished with, I'm glad I've come to the end of that. And that's the judgment of the experience. Days or weeks or months later, we can be talking to other people about the same experience, and the description and the judgment has changed. It was the best thing that ever happened to me. When he walked out of my house and said he wasn't coming back, it was the best thing in my life. At the time, the judgment was dramatically different. So we need a spaciousness, an ability, a capacity in life to be able to accommodate experience and judgment. Why? That's life. There's no life outside of it. That's it. No one can show a life outside experience, description, and judgment that goes with it. That is it. And because that is it, it's not that big a deal. Not that big a deal. And the teachings remind us of that again and again, in such a way we say, hey, this polarity of moving between birth and through to death, between the beginning of experience and the end of experience, we can embrace it. We can embrace it totally. All of it. And in our embracing of it, we're very inclusive and we can accommodate it all. And why can we accommodate it all? Because it's all accommodated anyway. Everything is accommodated. And as human beings, we are part of that accommodation. And so the field of experiences, as I say, are not that big a deal. It can't be anything more than feelings, thoughts, perceptions, unfolding experiences going on. Hey. It all falls into place. And sometimes on a lovely evening, we walk out and we just look up at the night skies, see the stars, we look across to the olive groves, we look in the grounds of the monastery, we look around us, we sense the stillness of things and say, in all that goes on, how easily and effortlessly it's all accommodated. And that capacity to accommodate, that which makes everything possible, that which the Buddhists call emptiness, or call nirvana, because they can't find the word and never could find the word which got close to it. Yet we can sense it, just because our whole existence is already accommodated. And in that, we share our common humanity. May all beings live with love. May all beings live with awareness. May all beings be in touch with that which accommodates all.